start and go. Okay. So, so yesterday we mostly wrapped up the question, the Bali, the Rishalmi. The last point on that page, if you noticed at the end of Beit Yosef, was Beit Yosef suggested an interesting position, which was, do you remember, did any of you get the end of the Beit Yosef, his second half of it? Okay, so I'll pull that up just for a second. But if you looked at the end of that, that passage in the Beit Yosef, he has a fascinating suggestion that not only do you not do say Zichron Trua on Shabbos, but that you might say Zichron Trua at night, right? Because night is not the time of Tkiat Shofar. Let me pull it up for a second. There we go.
But it would still be Yom Trua, though, because Yom is...
Very good. And I assume, and that's, I think, exactly what Gavi says. I think the reason we don't paskin this way is because, right, the assumption of that position is that you say Zichron Trua whenever you can't practically blow. The maskana, what we do is that, no, it's about the type of day that it is. If it's type of day when you blow the shofar, even if now you can't practically blow the shofar, it doesn't matter. Which pushes us in the idea that we developed yesterday, that the fact that we say Zichron Trua on Shabbat is not just a technicality. It reflects something fundamental about the day. So look here, just the latter half there of the Beit Yosef, quoting Shuman Hadeshen, the Katab B'Shuman Hadeshen, generally Sheish Lomar B'Kadishu V'Tila Arvit Zichron Trua, the Shuman Hadeshen, who, Gavi, let's see if you remember what's special about Shuman Hadeshen, who wrote the Shuman Hadeshen, what's special about the Shuman Hadeshen, all that stuff. Shuman Hadeshen is Rabbi Yisrael Isserlein. He's 15th century, and he has the clean sweep of Shulchan Aruch, right? All 345 of his Shuvot are quoted somewhere in Shulchan Aruch and Nusay Kalin. He's a very important posek, and again, as I've said every single time, that's what I heard from Rav Schechter. I have no idea if it's true. I've never checked it. I'm sure Rav Schechter knows better than I do. I do not know the Shuman Hadeshen or Shulchan Aruch well enough to know if that is true, but he's a very important posek. So the Shuman Hadeshen, right? Generally, sheyesh lomar b'kiddush uvidilat arvit zichron trua afilu kshechal yod kol. That even during week, at night, since you don't blow the shofar, you say zichron trua. Mishum de laila lav zman trua. But he notes, ava olam lo nagu kain. And the reason is exactly what Gavi said. Vatam mishum de lo dami l'shabbat. Dehacha hu yom zman trua l'machar. Right? The difference is that it's not about can practically blow shofar now, it's about whether the day is defined as Yom Trua. And a regular Rosh Hashanah where you're going to blow the next day, just as you don't blow at night, doesn't mean that the day is not a Yom Trua, it just means that now is not the time when you shofar. Okay, that was just the last point I wanted to make on that. Now let's move to what I want to talk about today. So, the topic, as I said, that I want to talk about is, okay, let's say you do blow the shofar. Chazal say you're not supposed to. Now what? Okay, now what? Did you fulfill a mitzvah? I mean, the question I'm really asking is, what is the rabbinic power to tell you, right, how much power do they have over mitzvot d'oraita? Now, the reason that they are allowed to tell you not to blow the shofar is part of a very far-reaching halachic and philosophical topic called Akirat Davar Min HaTorah. The main sugya of it is in Yivamot, Daf Peitet, through Daf Tzadi. But basically, Koach Nit Nabiyat Chachamim La'akor Davar Min HaTorah, the rabbis have the power to uproot things in the Torah. The way the Bavli seems to conclude is b'shev ve'al ta'aseh, only passively, meaning they can tell you don't perform a mitzvah. They cannot tell you to violate an avera. The Yerushalmi seems not to paskin that way. The Yerushalmi seems to paskin the koach nabiyat chachamim la'kor davar min ha'Torah afilu b'kum va'aseh, that Chazal have the power to uproot the Torah even actively. It's a fascinating topic. Tosfot seems to fundamentally agree with the Yerushalmi against the Bavli and interprets the Bavli in a way that allows for active uprooting of the Torah. And then you have all types of interesting issues there, right? Philosophically, why are they allowed to do that? Practically, who's allowed to do that? Is it only the Sanhedrin? Is it any Beit Din, even a Beit Din of three? Is that crazy? Maybe it is. Do Poskim still use it nowadays? Short answer is yes. Everyone thinks no, but I can give you a tshuva of Moshe Feinstein where he invokes it. I can give you a tshuva of Yosef where he invokes it. I can give you a tshuva of 3DH where he invokes it. They don't invoke it by itself. They try to hedge, but they all do quote it as at least one of the possibilities in practical Shuvot. So that's three 20th century poskim who invoke it at some point, in some way, shape, or form. What?
In what context?
The Shrita Eish, it's one of the arguments that he invokes in the context of his Kol Isha Tshuva. For Moshe, it's one of the arguments he invokes in terms of allowing people to take money for being Rebbeim, Rabbanim in Kollel, following Kesef Mishnah. And Rav Avadia uses it as one of his arguments in permitting people to marry Karaites. Okay, so the implications are far-reaching. And yes, when people tell me it's never used anymore, I pull out, I give a share of this once. I gave, you know, I was like, here's three 20th century Shuvot where people invoked it in some way, Lamaisa, not as the only logic, but it's not, clearly not off limits entirely, but fascinating for another time. We can marry Karaites. Yes, I have a cousin who's married to a Karaite. Yes. You know, meaning he's a Chiloni Karaite, she's a Chiloni non-Karaite. I don't really, you know. They're both, you know, like Chiloni Israelis. How practically different that looks, I don't know. But the rabbi, according to the rabbi, they are allowed to marry because it was the Pesach of Avada, and they are Sephardi. So I don't know if the rabbi distinguishes, but if they do distinguish and follow Avada only for Sephardim, and they can still marry, I don't know what to tell you. I really didn't know that there were like Karaites around practically, but then like my wife's cousin married a Karaite. So there you go. Now I know they exist. Okay. So let us go to this topic. So that's the background we're not going to get into. But assuming that background, now the rabbis tell you don't do it. So do you fulfill the mitzvah? Okay? So, first things first. If we interpret the sugya the way we basically teased out from Yehonatan yesterday, which is that if you want to synthesize the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, you can do that by saying there is no mitzvah according to the Bavli or the Yerushalmi, only Rishut. Right? There's no mitzvah on anybody. It's just optional. And then the question is, once it's optional, the rabbis say don't do it. So that really would lower the stakes here. Because you'd say, look, the Bavli doesn't think there's a mitzvah that Chazal told you not to do. They think there's a Rishut that Chazal told you not to do. It's just optional. So then this is not really such a big, you know, it's not such a big issue. Okay. I mean, what does that mean? Did I or did I not fulfill an optional mitzvah? I don't know, right? The real question is the simple understanding how most people understand the Bavli, which is that if you ask God and say, should I blow the shofar on Shabbat? He would say, yes, blow the shofar on Shabbat. Right? Next Shabbat, as crazy as that is, right? I know you've been in quarantine, probably feeling of time is not normal, but yes, a week from this Shabbat, amazingly. There's
this next Shabbat.
Yes, isn't that wild? No, I know. Yes, Lichot is this Motzei Shabbat already. Yes, it's crazy. It's crazy. I have like time.
It's like a blue body.
Yes. Look, time in quarantine or even in the Katsi quarantine we had, you know, in after Purim, which was, you know, 6 months ago already. Time is like, you know, if it weren't for like Shir Shal Yom, I don't know if I would know what day it is, right? I have to like remind myself in the morning. It's, yeah. But yes, we start Slichot and Matzai Shabbat, and Rosh Hashanah is only a week from this coming Shabbat. Yes, wild. Wild as that is. So God would tell you, blow the shofar. And the rabbis come and say, look, we want to protect Shabbat. We don't want you to carry Arba Amot Birshut HaRabim. So you can't blow the shofar at all because, you know, you might be in whatever lockdown they're planning for Rosh Hashanah and you're not so good at blowing the shofar. So you'll walk from 39 to the 35 to learn how to blow a shofar. And we don't want you to do that, so we tell you don't blow the shofar at all. And the second day, you can do that because you're allowed to carry a note. Okay? Fine. You decide you're going to blow the shofar. Now what? Right? Not you. Someone who doesn't care about Chazal. Okay? None of you. God forbid. Somebody else who is questionable of the entire rabbinic establishment. So he doesn't want to. I don't buy this old Russia thing. I don't buy these zeros. Or someone really, really believes that there is no Rishut HaRabim nowadays. So he just doesn't understand why this Takana should exist. Right? He's totally convinced by these all those fascinating reads of all of Mesechet Erevin and Shabbat, which may or may not be recorded in Shulchan Aruch, but whatever. Whatever the case may be, decides to blow the shofar on Shabbat. Now what? So what are the possibilities? Right? Now what? Right, what are the logical possibilities? How do we look at him in heaven? Right?
Either you get sort of a mitzvah, or nothing, or it's an affair.
Right, so one possibility is he did a mitzvah, he also violated a rabbinic command, and up, you know, when he gets to Shemaim, God will have to square those together. You have a check for shofar and X for violating what the rabbi said, and you know, somehow he'll have to come up with a cheshbon for you. Okay?
I'm just wondering, how would we go apply some of Bavera?
So formally, it's probably not the full mitzvah Bavera because it's a rabbinic, right, violation, right? It's but it might be something like that. But you could basically take what Rami is saying and take to the extreme, which is no, right? Once the rabbis say don't do it, so it's wrong to do it. And God himself concedes the point. And now you blow the shofar, the rabbis have successfully removed the schar. I don't know how they do that, but they do it, right? They remove it. You didn't fulfill the mitzvah. That's it. And that is the million-dollar question here. And as you know, I noted, this is not the only case when you have to ask that, right? You have to ask it here, you'd have to ask it by shofar, but you have to ask it really in a lot of places, like, you know, the examples we'll look at, saying Kriyat Shema after Chatzot, like sitting in a sukkah in a way which is permitted me to write up forbidden me derabanan, right? Those are the two examples that we're really gonna look at. And as we'll see.
You're sitting in the sukkah when it's raining.
So that's different, because there you, right, sitting in the sukkah when it's raining, as Chazal understand it, you're exempt biblically, right? Not rabbinically, you're biblically exempt, because it's dire patrim and asukkah, right? So there, right? So there, right, and the Yerushalmi is quite harsh in that particular one, right? Yerushalmi there says that kol patrim and hadavar oseyu nir hedya, right? Anyone who's exempt from something and does it anyways, what's hedya?
Normal.
So right. So in right. We usually use like regular, but technically, where's the word come from? Right. It means the same thing often that the English equivalent means.
Idiot.
Thank you. Hedged and idiot are the same word. Yes. Right. That's what it means. He's an idiot. Yes, they're etymologically related. So we're very not happy with such a person who eats in the sukkah while it's raining, really raining. But that's different, right? There he's fundamentally exempt. Here we assume that he's obligated, right? According to the Bavli, the simple shot of the Bavli. So what happens? Now, logically, each of them has an advantage and has a disadvantage. What's the advantage of saying that he doesn't fulfill a mitzvah? Or does? Pick one, right? Which one is more intuitive to you? There's no right or wrong answer. What's intuitive?
You read the question.
Meaning, which would you think, right? Which you think is right? Why? And justify it, right? Do you think it makes more sense when the rabbis tell you, don't do it, and you do it anyways? That you fulfill a mitzvah d'oraita, you just violate a mitzvah d'rabban, you know, an avera d'rabbanan, or that somehow the rabbis make it that you didn't fulfill the mitzvah at all, which is more intuitive to you, right? Which would make sense to you? Rami has already staked out a position, right? Rami thinks it makes more sense that you don't fulfill the mitzvah because there's some sort of a mitzvah b'avera here, right? And you shouldn't have done it. So to say that you get reward for doing that which you should not have done, that seems very unlikely. Right, that was the position that Rami staked at.
I would take the other side that.
Good. Why?
You fulfill the right to obligation, whatever it is. But on top of that, you also get this rabbinic avera.
Good. What drives you to that position? Right. Why is that intuitive to you?
Because the rabbis can't just outright negate a deraita.
Right. So the logic to saying what Yonatan says is where the rabbis get it's one thing to say the rabbis are allowed to tell you to not do a mitzvah, because that's telling you in practice what to do and what not to do. to say that some of you don't get sar implies that they have some control over the metaphysical fabric of the universe, which is surprising, right? Good. So, Rami, you want to respond? Well, we'll let you fight it out.
So, the thing is that there are these rabbinic, like, rabbinic authority isn't just coming out of the nowhere. It's it's sort of derived from the power, and so therefore, like, they have the authority to make these, like, those questioning that you shouldn't do that. So, I don't know, like, for God to have, like, this secret reward if you, like, break,
Right. So Rami is making what I think is a pretty good argument, which is, look, rabbinic power is grounded in the Torah. And I think more than that, right? Rami's last point is, well, what would that even make, right? How does that make sense? If you fulfill the mitzvah, you're violating the Rabbanan, meaning, what does that mean? Meaning, the rabbis are stronger than the Rabbanan. So now, you violated the rabbis and you blew shofar, and you're going to tell me that in Shamayim, I'm going to check on a right on an X on a Rabbanan. It makes no sense. That what are the rabbis doing? Why should I ever listen to the rabbis when they tell me not to do a mitzvah? Right? Meaning, if there's any meaning to their takana, it must be that when they say something, it reflects what I'm supposed to do. Right? Because their power is grounded in the Torah. And I don't know how it works. So I think you could divide. Right? One way is to come up with these strong thesis and say that the rabbis actually have a power to change the metaphysical reality of the world, and therefore you don't fulfill the mitzvah. An alternate way, which I think is more what Rami is actually saying, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, Rami, is no. It's not that they're changing the fabric of reality. That God wants you to listen to the rabbis. If you don't, it's not, they don't have to do anything, right? They're not uprooting the mitzvah. It's that now that you're supposed to listen to the rabbis, you're not supposed to be doing the mitzvah, and God isn't going to be happy with you because you did a mitzvah because he wants you to listen to the rabbis. Now, you could come up with middle positions like, yeah, technically you fulfilled the mitzvah, but it's not what God wanted. So that's, we don't call that a mitzvah, something more amorphous like that. Yonadab. Go, push back.
I think there's another two and a half position again here, where it depends somewhat on your intent. If you intended to, you know, violate a derabanan and do this, you know, deraita, you know, because it's a derabanan, but there's still deraita. Like, if you have in mind that there is a derabanan, you know, Xera against this, but you still did it anyways, that might count against you. But if you don't have it at all, this Derabana Xera, and you do the Derabana anyways, then that might only count for Derabana.
Right. So what you're putting down, I think, is pulling out is that the two formulations I gave of Rami's, right, position are really two different positions, right? To say that the rabbis have the power to change the metaphysical reality. So then it doesn't matter. Let's put it that way, right? Meaning, if someone just forgot it was Shabbos because we're in quarantine for weeks and, like, no one doesn't remember what day of the week it is, he knows it's Rosh Hashanah, but he forgot it's Shabbos, so he blows the shofar. So if the rabbi, the reason you don't fulfill them is because you think the rabbis have control over the reality of the world, so even though it was an accidental thing, he didn't mean to go against the rabbis, he wouldn't fulfill them as a shofar. But if you think, no, the rabbis don't have the power to change reality, it's just that you are a rebel against the rabbis. So God is going to not want your mitzvah. So then if you rebel against the rabbis, you say, I don't believe in the rabbinic establishment, I'm going to blow the shofar anyways. So God isn't happy with you, you don't fulfill the mitzvah. But if, betumas libcha, right, you forgot what day it is, right, you haven't seen the light of day in 14 days, right, in 14 days, you forgot it was Shabbos. So you, right, you blew the shofar, so then, right, through the back door, you fulfill the mitzvah d'oraisa. Because you forgot, you weren't going to answer Rabbi, you just forgot about it, right? But you knew it was right, so you blew the shofar, right? That would be the difference between saying that the reason you don't fulfill the mitzvah is because rabbis changed the metaphysical reality and saying, no, it's just that we're a rebel. It's mitzvah b'avera. There's all this negativity wrapped up in it, so that is what discounted mitzvah, right? Not that the rabbis somehow removed the reward, it's that God doesn't want you to be going against the rabbis, and therefore it poisons the whole scene. Right? And that would be, so that would be two or three possibilities, right? Two and a half, whatever we can call it, right? If we put it here in the chat, right? One, right, you don't get reward, right? Because 1A, right? The rabbis remove the metaphysical reward. Right, 1B, once you rebel against the rabbis, it becomes some sort of mitzvah, abba, avera, or 2, right, you do fulfill, right, you do get, whatever, you do get biblical reward, okay? Yeah, Jonathan, go.
I have another argument in support of the first thing you said, or the thing that I said, of you get both a reward and an avera. It could be, I mean, you said, I think one of the responses was that why would you ever follow the Xerath or Ben if you still get the reward?
Go ahead.
So it could just be that the avera, so to say, is worse than whatever scar you're going to get from the mitzvah.
Right, and that's what you'd have to answer. You'd have to say that, right, you have to say. Yonatan is 100% right. You have to say, yes, one is biblical, one's rabbinic. But the fact that God wants you to listen to the rabbis means that in the end of the day, you're never going to come out positive on this, right? Because what you did is always systematically wrong, right? It goes against the, right, what God wants, right? And I think the answer is going to be somewhat is that if we think in a little bit less formal terms, right, either... Right, you could subdivide either to say something like, right, right, the sin of violating a rabbinic command is worse than the reward, or whatever, is greater than the reward of fulfilling an asay, which is a little bit of a weird formulation. But the more likely formulation is that we need to look at the big picture, right? It's just right, big picture, right, which is, God wants you to keep the system, so, right, he will ensure you don't come out on top for violating, right, something like that, right? Now, again, as I said, I didn't want to get too much into these, bizarre positions like right, the Orach Chaim, but I'll show it to you. One second. Hefker. Parshanut Tanakh. Let's see. Orach Chaim. Yeah, yeah, right? So you come up with a very strong formulation that they really do have the power to change the metaphysical reality, and that you would get from a wild position like this one, right? And this is an Orach Chaim. The Orach Chaim is commenting on Moshe says to God, Al tefen el minchatam, right? The people in Korach, karbanot, right? Don't listen to their karbanot. So the Orach Chaim sets forth this thesis, the da. Power to remove the reward that evil people have when they see that these evil people are in fact totally evil. V'hu sod tzadik moshel yirat elokim. Perush moshel b'yirat Hashem. This is what it means in Shmuel Bet, that the tzadik actually controls the fear of God, meaning he controls the fear of God. That they want to remove reward. What God himself wouldn't do. Just like in this world, the rabbi had the power to take away the property of sin. So by the same power, they are able to take away your reward, right? You can come up with these theses, right? That is a very wild thesis, but you could justify one A, right? 1A, that they actually remove the metaphysical reward with some sort of thesis like that. But let's look at what the the Mefarshim actually say on this. So let's turn to the sources now that we've outlined the theoretical possibilities, okay? So the first source we turn to, the first example where we'll test this, is the Mishnah in Brachot, right? The first Mishnah in Shas, which I hope at some point all of you have seen, right? In one way or another. So who wants to take the first Mishnah in Shas? Right? This is not so tricky. I'm not read yet. Who has not read? Adam, you haven't read yet. I see. You're with me. Okay, your turn then. Anyway, first Mishnah in Shas.
When do we recite Shemar at night? In the time when the Quran and it would enter to their children. Also, Hashmira, Harishmael, and then the first watch. Deeper Rabbi Eliezer, this is the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer. Nachachamim, Nachachamim, say until midnight. Rabban Gamil, Rabban Gamil, says, Achiyada, and Hashava, until dawn. Masa, there was a Muslim Shabbat Banav that made base Hamishta, where his son came to him from a party. Although, they said to him, "No Kavino is Shema." He didn't say Shema. He didn't read anything. He said to them, "In La Lava, Amir Hashachar, if the sun didn't rise here, you're obligated to read it." And it's not only with this. Probably with anything that the Chachamim say you have until Chatzos, you really have until Amud Hashachar. Victor, Chalavim, Beverim, Mitzmosan, Chayyar Amud Hashachar. So for the burning of the rooms and plexus, the leftover rhythms and facts of the Beis Hamikdash, they had until Amud Hashachar to burn them according to him, but according to the Chachamim and Chatzos. Everything that needed to be eaten within one day. In order to stop a person from sinning.
Good. Right. So the first example that we have is, right, as the Mishnah tells us, from a biblical perspective, are you allowed to read Shema until right, or dawn? Yes. But in order to prevent you from going home, relaxing, watching a few movies, and never getting around to saying, the deadline is Chatzot, right? Because otherwise they're afraid that you'll just be, right? You'll keep going. You're saying, I'm binge watching whatever until morning. I'll say Shema at some point. Right, and then you're on your, I don't know how many episodes you can binge watch in a night. I've never done it, but whatever. Right, as you're finishing, the sun is already peeking through. You're like, shoot, I missed Kriyat Shema. Right. We don't want you to do that, so we tell you to do it by Chatzot. So you at least take a Kriyat Shema break before midnight because you have a deadline. But what happens if somebody says Shema after, or plans to say Shema after, right? So now what? Yes, Yonatan.
I was just going to question, so the Mishnah says that that when the Chumim say so really a mitzvah can be performed until dawn, but they're just doing it as a Xavier, right?
Yeah.
My question is, how can we say that? I mean, if the Chachamim are decreeing till Chatzot, how can we then extend it unless they say themselves?
Good. So this is going to be part of the question, is what do they mean? And how can you say that? And what does it make, right? Meaning, Yonadan's point is, what do you mean? You can't say it past. You can say it past Chatzot, but what do you got? Right? What does this even mean, right? That's exactly what's going to push people, right? It's going to push them, the Mefarshim, to say, no, you can't do that. We'll see that in a minute. But you see what the question is here, right? What pushes you in favor of saying you could still say it after Chatzot is, well, biblically you're allowed to, so you should fulfill the mitzvah. What pushes you against it is, if that's true, then what are the rabbis doing? What did they accomplish, right? If there's no real limit, because you could just say it afterwards and you'll still get the schar, so What it was just advice? It was a lie? Like, what was it? Right? That's the tension. That's the interpretive question that you need to deal with. Okay? Let's look at one more example, and then, because these are the ones that the Rishonim are going to be playing off of. And then we'll look at the two sides. The other example that the Rishonim pick up, this Mishnah in the second parak of Sukkah. So who wants to take the Mishnah? Adam can continue, or someone else can volunteer to relieve Adam. Ah, Adam, good. Okay, go ahead.
Mishnah of the Sukkah, one who has his head and most of himself in the Sukkah, his table is within his house. Was there an incident where the elders of Beis Shammai and the elders of Beis Hillel were walking as Rabbi Yochanan ben Hacharani to the house of Rabbi Yochanan, the son of the Chof. Umitahu Shehaya Shev about exactly this, where he was sitting with his head and most of his body in the sukkah. And his table was in his house.
And they didn't say anything about it, right? They didn't challenge it.
Yes. Amr Lahan, Bishamai responded to them. Bishamai, Raya.
That's a rhetorical question, right? Is that proof?
Is that true?
Right. Afem Amrlo, in that story, what happened? What did they say to him?
They said to him, Imkein Ayusa Noheg, if this is your custom, Loki Yamtu Mitzvah to come in Miyamecha.
Okay, good.
Never fulfilled my Sukkah.
Good. So here's the question, right? The Mishnah tells us that there's a machloket. Hillel says how much of you need to fit in your Sukkah. If you fit in your sukkah, you're great. The table's in sukkah, no problem, right? You'll have your table outside the sukkah. You'll be in the sukkah, and you'll eat on your lap, right? You'll pull the food in as you're ready to eat, and you'll eat it right inside your mini sukkah. Beis Shammai says you can't do it, right? You need to have your table in the sukkah as well. Okay, that's the machloka. What interests me is what interests me shown to me here is one weird line. Which is that Beit Shammai said that they once said to someone who followed Beit Hillel's position, right? What did they say? They saw him eating with his table outside. Lo kiyamta mitzvah tzucha miyamecha. If this is what you're doing, you never fulfilled mitzvah tzucha. Now, what's the problem with that language?
It seems like the rabbinic gzera is overriding their rights.
Right. The problem is only rabbinic. And therefore, this language is suggested. So on the one hand, it might tell us the strong read, which is, lo kiyamta mitzvah tzukah. The rabbi somehow made it that you don't fulfill the mitzvah at all. You get no reward. What's the softer read? How would you push back on that read? But how would you say, read that line and say, no, you do fulfill the mitzvah. You just violate, you shouldn't do it because the rabbis didn't say it. How would you have to read the words, lo kiyamta mitzvah tzukah miyamecha? How would you have to read the words, you've never fulfilled tzukah? Yeah, Adam?
You've never fulfilled it.
Right. You just say, you never fulfilled it properly with all the rabbinic strictures, meaning not that you didn't fulfill it. You did. Yeah, sure, it was a tzukah. Right? And that's the two ways that it's going to divide. Okay, good. So now let's look at the Rishonim. So which one do you want to look at first, Kriyat Shema or tzukah? I put it in this direction. I don't really know why. It doesn't really matter, right? Ben Yonah is a little bit more forthcoming than Tosafot, but which one to start with? Doesn't matter to me. How about whoever volunteers to read can choose which one they want to read? Oh, come on. Yes, I know we've missed it. Now we've moved to harder reading. Okay, I'm still continuing. You are brave today. Okay, good. So what do you want? You want Tosafot or you want Rabbeinu Yonah?
Let's go with Tosfos.
Okay. Take it away. This is Tosfos and Gidav Gimel.
Okay. Tzarich Lomar, Deet Tzarich Hasam. You need to say that it's needed, that it's necessary, to include this, the Beis Hillel Mechamim, that Beis Hillel are stricken to the Ban, but Beis Shammai say that this is all a matter of
right, so let's focus on here on the second line. Ready? And lo yatsa yidei chovatel. Yeah.
So, according to Beis Shammai, you're not, you haven't fulfilled your obligation. Afilu de'oraisa, even de'oraisa. Ki de'ashkechan de Beis Shammai, yifan de Beis Shammai hecha des tiyasi ve apischa etimatel.
Mitalalta. This is an important word to know. This is mitalalta means sukkah in Aramaic. Right.
So, with sitting in an open sukkah, the Gezer Shama that they decreed there.
Shema Yimashech Achar Shulchano. Right. They decreed because they were worried you might be led after your table. Meaning, right. Once you're sitting,
right.
Your table's out of the sukkah. You'll be right going to the other side of the table to get food. Right.
Right.
Etc.
The comrade though, Kiyamta Mitzvah Sukkah and Miyamasa. And therefore they said that you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of sukkah in your days. You haven't fulfilled it.
Right, and from what we learn from Beit Shammai, the same will be true of Beit Hillel in parallel cases. Right, so simple pshat and Tosfos. Simple pshat. Some people argue on this. Rav Asher Weiss doesn't like this. Rav Asher Weiss doesn't like this whole idea, so he tries to reread Tosfos. But simple pshat and Tosfos is. Right? Which one? Right? Like Rami, that you don't fulfill the mitzvah d'oraita, or like Yonatan, that you do?
So,
you don't, right? He's pretty clear. Meaning, you really have to counter-read him to say he's not saying what he's saying. Right? He says, you don't fulfill it biblically. He says it twice in like three lines. The rabbis somehow get rid of it. I don't know if it's because they changed metaphysical reality. I don't know because God isn't happy with you. Because you're not supposed to be doing it, so he gets rid of it. I don't know if it's mitzvah above. It doesn't tell you. It doesn't tell you why. But Tosfos is pretty clear in simple pshat that when the rabbis say don't do something, if you do it anyways, even technically on a biblical level, you should fulfill the mitzvah. Once the rabbis say no, that's it. You don't fulfill it, right? Attack it, defend it however you want, right? We've gone through all the theoretical possibilities. Tosfos is not very forthcoming here. In terms of explaining how it works, why it works, he doesn't tell you. But he's pretty clear, I think, in terms of what he says. Okay. That's Tosfos. You know what? Before we look at Rabbeinu Yonah, let's look at the opposite extreme. Okay? Before we look at Tosfos, look at the Ran. Right? Rabbeinu Yonah is probably the lengthiest treatment that I know of in Rishonim. But the Ran is pretty short, and he's on the opposite side. Who wants to take up the Ran? Let's give Adam a break. Who wants to take up the Ran?
I could do it.
Okay, take it away.
Whoever doesn't say these three things, the Pesach,
right? So this one, I assume I didn't need to give you the background to this. You've heard of this phrase. You need to about, right? It's Rabbi Gamliel's famous statement. Which is, if you don't say Pesach Matu Marar, right, you don't fulfill your obligation. I hope to God you remember that line from the, you know, considering, as Rabbi Gamliel says, that's what you need to do and say at the Haggadah, you know, Seder to fulfill your mitzvah. I hope that you remember that one line because it is the most important part. So, good. So, on that line, so he wants to know, presumably, those are rabbinic additions, right, to particularly fulfill the mitzvah in that way. Good. So what does he say?
Kloma, meaning to say, lo yidei yo lo yatsay yidei chalato. He didn't fill his obligation kolai properly. Lo yatsay yidei chalato kolal lo kama. I'm saying you didn't fulfill it at all.
Right. Udikavate, and he says similarly. What other case does he say this about?
Udikavate basuka. Same thing as by sukkas. But when you're in your sukkah.
Right. Quote. Right. Now it's a quote. The line we just saw in the Mishnah. Right? This is the same theory of how you have to read that line in Sukkah, namely, right? By the way, this is the best way, right? I want you during the year to learn how to be careful readers. The problem is sometimes, as you see in the Rishonim, the Ram's solution to what sounds like an explicit Mishnah is Lav Dafka. Yeah, don't take it too seriously. Okay, there's nothing I can do about that, right? Meaning there's nothing I can do about that, right? The Ron's answer to what sounds like an explicit Mishnah is, don't read it too carefully. It's an expression. It's hyperbole. What do you want from my life, right? Okay, it's true. The rabbis use hyperbole. Okay, it happens, right? The Rivash has a whole tshuva about it in Tshuva Kofayin Aleph. They do it, right? They do it. But of course, that creates a metamachloket, which is whenever they do that, are they serious? Right, when they make these wild comparisons, does that mean you have to take them seriously? That itself is a machloket rishon macharon. So you can never win, right? Because some people say, "Oh, it's hyperbolic." No, there's no such thing as hyperbole. If it sounds that way, it's true, right? The Taz notes at the beginning of Simin Reish Membet, I think, right, that it's a machloket the tour and the it's also just Bnei Yeshua. It's a general machloket. But anyways, yeah. So the Ron's solution to the whole thing is Lav Dafka, right? Whatever. Yeah, continue.
The halo time is not the lo havi time. It's not the reason. The hahi elamishum dil atilim shuche batok shochano. But it's the reason that maybe he'll come to sit in it by his table inside the house, I think he's saying.
Right, right. I mean, that's the reason by Sukkah, yeah. The Ron makes the following argument, right? He makes a very specific argument. He says, look, why aren't you allowed to eat in a Sukkah when your table is outside? Dilma ati lim shuche, because you might end up outside the Sukkah. But he says, what happens if you violate the rabbinic law, you ate the Sukkah, and the kolhech of the lo imshich, but any case in which you didn't end up outside the sukkah, you are an expert at eating with your food on your lap. You didn't need to go out of the sukkah, right? You are a professional rude eater, right? You are fully happy to reach over the whole table and pull the food to you, right? You never get up. You never ask anyone to pass you food. You are happy to pull it over and shove it in your face, right? So you stayed in the sukkah, no problem. What say? Lo sagi de lo yatza. How can you tell me that you didn't fulfill your obligation to the sukkah? It must be you fulfilled the mitzvah. Right? So, Tosfot, I think, is pretty clear. He's staking out one of the formulations he suggested for Rami. And the Ron, pretty clearly, is staking out one of the formulations that we suggested for Yonatan. Right? I'm not sure which one. He's a little bit more forthcoming than Tosfot. Right? He's a little bit more forthcoming. I still don't know exactly which one he wants, right? Meaning, you could still read it in different ways. But yeah, Yonatan has an opinion. What does he think? What do you think the Ron means?
It would seem to me that he's of the opinion that it depends on your intent. I mean, if you're doing this as, you know, a rebellion against the rabbis, then obviously it's not something you do. But if you're just doing this because, you know, you don't have in mind.
So it could be. It could be, right? It's not clear that intent would make a difference. But you're right. Yeah. It's possible to think, look, I know myself, if I do it, so I shouldn't have done it. But I wasn't doing it to rebel. Maybe I was doing it because I thought realistically I could eat while staying in the sukkah. Okay, I shouldn't have done it. But you're going to tell me I didn't fulfill? It could be that that's something like what the Ron is thinking, right? And maybe the Ron would say differently. If, you know, you'd said, I want to stick it to the rabbis, right? I'm going to, you know, I could make a bigger sukkah, but I'm going to make it small, right? You know, I don't know, right? Maybe he would do that. I don't know. He's not that forthcoming in that sense. He doesn't detail it, but we seem to have as a machloket Tosfot and the Ron. The Tosfot thinks that if you fulfill a mitzvah d'oraita, the rabbis told you not to, somehow, biblically, you don't fulfill the mitzvah. And the Ron says, no, that's not the way life works. The rabbis told you not to do it. You shouldn't have done it. But if you did do it, okay, you still fulfill the mitzvah. Now, not so many people make the exact distinctions that Yohanan does, but as we'll see, some of the Achronim suggest that it might depend, right, that not all rabbinic commandments or rules are created equal. Right? It's possible that it will depend on the type of rabbinic command. Right? So far we've seen Tosfot makes a general statement, the Ron makes a general statement. Neither of them clarify if this would be true in every single rabbinic case. We don't know that yet. Right? We don't know. And it's that which leads some of the Achronim trying to come up with more sophisticated, nuanced middle positions. Always yes or always no. Okay? Did you guys get a chance to read Rabbeinu Yonah? Did anyone actually? Yeah? Okay. So let's try to get through Rabbeinu Yonah, and maybe tomorrow we'll either you can decide you want to try longish Achronim, right? Or we can start by reading the Achronim inside, and you can start on the next source sheet. We can figure it out however you want. Right, the Kavod Kushiyata is not short. It's not a hard Hebrew, but I didn't give it to you because it's not short and I didn't want you to spend your whole time reading it, but it's the reading-wise, it's pretty easy. Okay, so let's look at Rabbeinu Yonah. So Rabbeinu Yonah now going back to the Kriyat Shema case, and he says, V'yesh la'akshot l'rabbanan. We now have to ask on the rabbis, Da'amri da'filu di'avar eino yotzei ela ad chatzot. Im avar chatzot ma'yehidino. Now we got to ask, okay, the rabbis say don't say Shema past Chatzot. But what if you did? She'im nomar shelo yikra klal. So now he says, if what the rabbis want you to do is, look, now it's 2 in the morning. It's past Chatzot. You shouldn't have done it. Now you're at 2. You do, right? Rabbeinu Yonah is going farther. He's asking a proactive question, right? Now, not if you say Kriyat Shema, will you fulfill the mitzvah? But should you say Kriyat Shema, it's 2 in the morning. So he says, if you'll say read not to read it, kasha. Kaven the kriyat shma chiyuv menatei ech yecholim chachamim lefatcho mimenu. How could the rabbis tell you not to say shma? You're allowed to say shma now, and it's a biblical mitzvah. They're going to tell you not to do the mitzvah. That makes no sense. Ve'it da'amri, disvir lehu, da'achar chatzot, koreyota below brachot. So some people have a compromise. The rabbis can tell you, after chatzot, don't say the brachot at all. Why? Shabrachor in an elamid rabbanan. Yecholin hein bishelahem. Brachor rabbinic. So the rabbis have the power over their own rules. Limnoa shelo yomaratan achash avar zehazman. The rabbis have total control over their own laws. Abul kriyat shma shehu minat Torah. Koreo takal alayla. But kriyat shma you should say. So if I stop there for Rabbeinu Yonah, Rabbeinu Yonah thinks like Yehonatan, but why? Right? Why does he think that?
Because there's two separate things. One writes about the brachot, and one so
that's why he thinks about the brachot, right. But why does he think that not only do you get reward for saying Shema, but that you actively should say Shema? Right? What's his logic? What's driving him to stake out that position? What does he say? Right, he is conceptually clear. He says, "What's the reason?" Because
the rabbis don't have the power to change.
Yeah, right. That says it's a power thing. Right, this is a power question. It's an authority question. The rabbis have absolute authority over rabbinic law. So if they say you have a mitzvah to say brachot, they can also say, and that mitzvah expires at chatzot, and after that to say it is meaningless. But he doesn't believe the rabbis have the authority to tell you really to not fulfill mitzvah d'oraita. Yes, Yonah.
If the Chachamim, though, in the Mishnah, we're referring to not Kriyat Shema, but just the bracha of Shema, as Rabbi Yonah seems to be saying here, wouldn't the idea that when the Chachamim say Ad Chatzot really extends till dawn still apply despite that? So wouldn't the bracha also then extend till dawn?
Well, not necessarily, right? Because he could be saying that that's exactly what the rabbis did. Is they said, the rabbinic accoutrements to the mitzvah at chatzot, we're not going to let you do anymore in order to motivate you to be able to fulfill the whole mitzvah in the right time. After that, we don't have the authority to tell you shema, but we're going to make it a less fulfilling experience to remind you that you shouldn't be doing that. Right? Something like that is what Rabbeinu Yonah is going to want.
It just seems difficult to me to extrapolate that from the singular language of the Hachamim in the Mishnah.
Yes, and Rabbeinu Yonah, like I said, Tosfot takes one position out. Rabbeinu takes another position. Rabbeinu Yonah is the one who has a conversation. Right? Rabbeinu Yonah is saying, here's one possibility, right? But then as we'll see, and maybe we should, if we continue Rabbeinu Yonah now, we won't get it. So let's continue with Rabbeinu Yonah tomorrow, and we'll try to think it out. But Rabbeinu Yonah is going, right, first of all, he's asking a more ambitious question, right, which is not just post facto. If you did it, will you fulfill the mitzvah? But when the rabbis tell you to do something, are they really telling you, don't do it, even if that means giving up on a mitzvah d'oraita? Are they telling you you shouldn't? Right, he's asking the proactive, say the ab initio question, but it's not really true because the whole case has been d'evet. Right, I mean, this is not l'chatchila. This is like l'chatchila in a situation. Right, so it's not really, ab initio is Latin for l'chatchila. Asking a slightly different question, but we'll come back to Rabbeinu Yonah tomorrow. And like I said, if you finish this and you want to, right, definitely read the shorter pieces I gave you in the Achronim, Rabbi Kiva Eger and the Avni Nezer. The most expansive discussion, as I said, is from the Kaaba de Kushiyata of the Chalkat Yoav, which is a very funny book. Very, very funny book. It's exactly what it's, right? Kaaba de Kushiyata, literally, it's a pun, right? A Kaaba is a measurement, right? Like a kav. It's like a basket, a kav basket. Kushiyata could be a type of a vegetable, but this book is actually, it's gematria. Kuf bet 103 de Kushiyata of questions. And it's just 103 random questions that he wanted to deal with. And he wrote a book of just like lumdish treatises on 103 conceptual questions that he liked. And it's just, so it's the 103 questions. That's what the book is. It's fascinating. But start by really reading Rabbeinu Yonah, and we'll try to figure out his, which is, you know, is more nuanced and really tries to weigh both sides. So we'll continue with that tomorrow, and I guess unless we really rush, that's probably what we'll end on before you guys go on your tomorrow. Okay.